Before we dive into today's episode, I just wanted to set up a few things. Last week was our memorial to my late great co-host, Scott Wampler. During that chat, I laid out my plans for the show going forward, but I know not everybody was ready to take that emotional hit and maybe didn't hear about that. So the quick version is when Scott passed, we had 3 KingCast episodes in the bank. Instead of Scott bombing you throughout the next couple of months, I figured I'd run all the ones we had ready to go, kind of back to back, starting with today's episode. When we run out of Scott episodes, I'll be joined by a guest co-host every week. I already have the first guest co-host and a very cool special guest for us to interview all lined up. The show won't be the same without Scott, but there's still some King shit left to cover. So with that said, let's jump into our sponsors, shall we? From Gretchen Felker Martin, the acclaimed author of Manhunt, comes Cuckoo, a vicious new audiobook about a group of teens who must stay true to themselves while in a conversion camp from hell. In the summer of 1995, 7 queer kids, abandoned by their parents at a remote conversion camp, come face to face with something evil buried deep in the desert. 16 years later, they are forced to confront it once more. The fate of the world depends on it. Listen to a full cast narrate the book Roxane Gay calls absolutely masterful. Cuckoo is available wherever audiobooks are sold. And that just leaves the house ad. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you'll need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you gotta do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And it doesn't end there, folks. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. With all that said, let's get on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bodies
want to
go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name's Scott Wampler.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. We've got a great show for you all this week, folks. Our guests are making their second appearance on the KingCast, and we are delighted to be speaking with them again. They are the masterminds behind the Found Footage Festival, a truly bizarre and hilarious live show that's been touring the world ever since its inception in 2004. And they are also the stars of last year's excellent documentary, Chop and Steal, which I cannot impress upon you enough that you need to see that movie. Noted pranksters with a talent for making the right people very, very mad. They are here today to discuss not one, but 2 Stephen King efforts. Last year's Holly, the latest entry in King's long-running Holly Gibney series of novels, and 1982's Creepshow, written by King and directed by the late, great George A. Romero. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Joe Pickett and Nick Prewer back to the KingCast stage. How are you doing today, boys?
Good. Thanks for having us back. Good to be back.
Excellent. Yes. Thanks, guys.
Very excited to talk to you. We loved your first appearance on the show. You guys are fun. You guys are fun to talk to. I see you've been out on tour recently, and you've got a number of dates lined up over the next few months. I wanted to talk to you about the amount of travel you're doing with this show and how you cope with it. Because Vespi is, I think he's a better traveler than I am. Would you think that's fair, Vespi?
Oh, yeah, because I was well versed in it in my back in the Ain't It Cool days, since I was one of the top guys. I got my pick of all the set visits and junket trips and everything. So there were, if I was at home for 2 months straight, it was weird. Like, you know, there would be weeks. I remember there was one time I went to, they offered a set visit to Hostel 2 in Prague, and I really wanted to go, but it was right in the middle of Fantastic Fest. So and listen, I don't think I could pull this off now. I'm over 40. This isn't gonna work. This is a young man's game. But I was covering Fantastic Fest, then I like for 3 days, and then that next morning I woke up, got on an airplane to Prague, arrived on set, did my set visit without getting any sleep,
Oh boy.
Went to bed. They had like a half day free in Prague to go look around, do touristy shit, and then got on an airplane, got back to Fantastic Fest and covered like day five or, you know, on or whatever.
Absolutely. Fuck yes. That.
Yeah.
Like, that sounds very familiar. Like we do that all the time. We did one where we went to, we did the Sydney Underground Film Festival in Australia, and we were in the air longer than we were in Sydney, actually. Mm. So we go and we wake up at 7 o'clock in the evening, go do our show, you know, and then hop on a plane back. And I remember we had to do the Tosh show the next day in LA. So we got back and it was just like, I didn't know which way was up at that point. Oh. So yeah, no, it's whirlwind trips.
I can't imagine doing that and performing, because it's one thing to be a nerd that's going and, you know, sitting on a set, you know, taking notes or whatever, or doing a quick interview that you can edit all your insanity out of.
Yeah.
Your travel weary insanity. But to actually have to go up and then perform for multiple hours.
I had an experience recently where I had a board game that came out through Mondo called Dream Crush. And I was demoing it at the big board game convention, Gen Con in Indianapolis. It was the height of COVID. I masked for 8 hours a day demoing this game.
Right.
And then we had a show on the Saturday of the convention in Los Angeles. So I was demoing the game in the morning, flew to LA a couple hours earlier there, and went straight from the airport, got on stage, did the show. I should mention that the night before in Indianapolis, they took us out to dinner, and I had some exotic Burmese food. So
you see where this is going, right?
on the plane to fly to LA, all of a sudden the worst diarrhea experience I've ever had is hitting me.
And Nick, you don't normally go number two on airplanes, right? Like, you will hold it.
I'm
until
like clockwork.
You, get to the...
you can set my watch to my bowel movements. And but this was, and I'm in the cab going like, I'm going to have him pull over in a ditch because there's nothing here. And I'm starting like biting the inside of my cheek to distract myself. And finally, like, I get there.
You can't relieve the pressure. Any little bit of relief could result in soiled pants. I most people know this feeling. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, or then you got close to the airport, you get that proximity effect where it's like, oh no, okay. So, and I'm like, the bathroom might not be.
Somehow your butt knows when it's close to a toilet. It's like a sixth sense.
And I told myself, okay, the bathroom might not be right when you get in, so I'm just like telling my bowels like this. I'm like, so I might have to go.
You set your bowels down.
Yeah. So, I go into the bathroom. Luckily, it was before security, and I'm like, if there's no stall available, I'm just going to go in the sink, because it was that bad. And I went in there, barged in, there was a stall open, and I sat down. And I remember the song that was playing, because you know how in airports, just the music is just blaring everywhere? And it was, as I'm going through this horrible pain, this real dark night of the soul, it was, sometimes when we touch, the promise is too much. And this is blaring over the speakers. And then I get a call from Tim League saying, hey, when do you get back tomorrow? Because we got to demo the game again on Sunday. So I was hoping that was it. It wasn't just part one. Took off, flew to LA. Luckily, that was it. Did the show, and then got on the red eye back and went straight to the convention to demo the game on Sunday. And I realized in your late 40s, it might be too late to be doing travel like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was much more fun in our 20s and 30s. And now 40s, it's just all about logistics and just like, you know, not doing it too much. We used to go 3 weeks at a time. There was one time we were doing a show in Seattle. We were playing Central Cinema there. And it's kind of a smaller theater. It's like 100 people. And we'd been playing there, I don't know, like 6-7 years at that point. And so our first two shows sold out on a Saturday night. And so we added a third show, which we never do three shows in one night. That's way too much. But we said yes, because the money was too good. And we flew in Saturday. And I remember by the time the third show came up, I actually fell asleep in my chair during Jack Rebney, during a Jack Rebney video. Like, that was
the angry art salesman.
And Nick had to nudge me awake. And then I had to wake up and then perform and be funny. And yeah. So.
Well, I guess my ultimate point here is, you know, we've got a number of live shows that are coming up later this year, only one of which has been announced. But I'm kind of dreading it. And I'm wondering if you have any tips for travel.
Let me also, just so they have an understanding of just how much you hate travel. We were trying to book something where we went out for a show and I'm like, okay, cool. There's this other thing that we should probably do like 2 weeks after we get back from this. And Scott's like, no, I'm out. I'm like, what? Well, no. Oh, you have something conflicting. He's like, no, that's too close to the travel. And I'm just like, it's 2 weeks after we get back. And you're like, nope.
I know.
Yeah. So that is the mind you are dealing with here. So
I hate traveling so much. Like,
don't you like getting to the hotel and watching like the local like news channel? I just love that. Like watching the local action news, like for Cincinnati. That's my favorite.
Absolutely
part.
Not.
Or watching the local public access. Oh man, I look forward to that every time.
Listen, I before the pandemic, I was a very social guy. I used to go out 4 nights a week. Probably, you know, doing something or another, events or screenings or hanging out with friends at a bar, whatever the fucking case may be. But the pandemic really turned me into a shut-in, and I still have not shaken that. Like, air travel is so demoralizing just at a base level that it's like it's a chore for me to do that shit. And
yeah. I'm not a fan of air travel either. If I can drive, if it's 10 hours away on a drive, I would rather drive 10 hours than do the lines and do the air travel. Just can't stand it. I get it. One thing that we started doing on this most recent tour, we're on volume 10 of the Found Footage Festival right now. We used to always get mid-tier hotels and then get the double bed in the room where it's like, you know, we pay $100 for a Holiday Inn Express and then share the room. Now we go down lower. We'll go down to like one-star hotels so we each get our own room. Mm-hmm. And that's made a world of difference, even though Nick calls them dog's mouth hotels, where it just smells like a dog's mouth when you walk in
and it's a cigarette mixed with the inside of a dog's mouth. And it's either scalding hot in there or freezing cold, and there's no in between those kind of hotels.
Yes. I've been to the Flamingo in Vegas.
You're familiar with the dog's mouth. And Joe's a loud snorer and I'm a light sleeper, so I'll take the dog's mouth if it means uninterrupted sleep.
Nick has like military grade earplugs that he puts in, and then three pillows on top of his head. So yeah, this has actually made traveling a lot. We spend a little bit extra, but we get our own rooms, and that's made a world of difference.
Yeah. Well, we definitely do that. I think we're both snorers. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was a snorer until recently.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I had no idea. No, I was married for a number of years.
You guys rock the CPAP?
You
guys CPAPers?
You know, no, but I actually, my doctor like looked at my blood and said, hey, maybe you have sleep apnea. I'm like, how the fuck do you know that looking at my blood? Yeah. And I think the undercurrent was also you're fat and over 40. So you probably do. He's like, do you snore? I said, yeah. He's like, you have sleep apnea. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I like did one of those at home test things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know if you've ever done it. It's so fucking weird because you have to strap this like monitor like to your chest.
Yeah.
But the strap is like you need to have a fucking engineering degree to understand how to tighten and loosen the strap. And so it took me like pretty much the entire night leading up to it to figure out how to get it on secure enough that it wasn't choking me, but also that it would do readings. And even so, in the middle of the night, I would get like an alert from the thing going, oh, it's not on right.
Oh,
and then they looked at it at all the results later and said, yep, you probably have sleep apnea. You're going to need a CPAP. I said, great. And then my doctor proceeded to just ghost all my communication about it. So maybe I'll die in my sleep one night. You have no idea.
I had to do I went into the clinic to do the sleep study, which I think is worse, actually, because they do hook you up to all that shit. And then
you look like Nancy in A Nightmare on Elm Street. You got all the shit.
I took so many pictures of myself. I just looked horrifying. And, but
I think I offered to pay for this, by the way. I think whatever it takes to not have me smother you with a pillow in your sleep.
But there are the weird part is like you have somebody like watching you, monitoring you, so they can hear you. They can, you know, like they're watching you while you're sleeping, which is really creepy. And you know, I was holding in my farts because of it, so I feel like it. Like I felt like
that
like
skewed the results.
Yeah, I know exactly. So I don't know. I think the at home one sounds better to me, even though it was a pain in the ass.
It was, yeah. No, so to answer your question, I probably should use one, but apparently my snoring hasn't been as bad lately, so I don't know.
Maybe I highly recommend it. It's a world of difference with the sleep wise.
You were married and you never got yelled at for snoring?
No. I never heard a word about it. And then, you know, recently I was sharing a bed with somebody and it became a problem. You know, I was sharing a bed for some days at a time. And like day two, it was like, you were snoring very loudly last night.
It sounds sexy, but it's more of a Grandpa Joe situation. So.
It's so embarrassing.
Yeah. You know? Is it rhythmic snoring or is it the kind of like you're half dead? Like,
I have no idea.
Like, okay. All right.
I just know it was disruptive.
There's an app called Sleep Cycle where it records your snoring so you can hear it. And if it sounds like you're dying, you should probably get a CPAP. So there's Dr.
Man, I got so much shit to deal with.
Joe, I remember you told me like your doctor said if you lost 15 pounds, you wouldn't snore anymore. And right. You said, well, I guess I'm a snorer.
Yep. That's not going to happen. Yeah. They told me that most of my problems would go away if I lost 15 pounds. And I was like, yeah, it's not going to happen. So just give me the medication.
That sounds like most doctor's solution. It's like, stop being as fat.
Yeah.
I know. Like, anything. Oh, you got joint pain. Stop being as fat.
Right. Right. I was like, yeah, but food tastes good.
Yeah. That's because you're.
I know when you booked us back on the show, you were hoping for snoring and diarrhea stories, and we've delivered so far. I just want to make that clear.
Oddly enough, these are all things that you would find in the Stephen King novel. I'm sure.
It's true. Yeah.
He would spend pages upon pages describing the sleep apnea.
I bet he has some great shit stories too. Everybody always has shit stories, you know. And I bet he has some incredible. Next time he's on your show. Dive into shit stories because I bet he has some stories to tell.
Yeah,
he has a story about a guy who gets locked in a porta potty that then gets tipped over.
Yep,
and he's got to escape from it.
Yeah,
it's called what the fuck is that called? Like in a very dark place or something.
Tight place or something.
Yeah, it is repulsive, but I highly recommend.
This is the man who thought up shit weasels as well. So he's got some poo-poo on his brain.
The Barfarama scene from Stand By Me. Yeah.
Andy Dufresne crawling through a mile of shit to get out of Shawshank.
Yeah,
that's
right. Like, yeah.
He likes the pee-pee and poo-poo that Stephen King.
Yeah.
He also has a story that he has talked about how people like, oh, how many story ideas come to you and you know, like, you can't finish him. And he always points to one. He's like, I don't know if it was a short story or there's a novel in there. He's like, but it's a great idea. And it's all about an airport bathroom. Have you heard this, Scott? Is this something you've ever come up on in your research?
Hold on.
So apparently it is the gist of the story is it's a, it's a husband and the wife and the husband goes to the bathroom and the wife goes to the bathroom, you know, the ladies and, you know, men's bathroom, different, whatever. And the husband finishes first and is out there waiting for his wife and she never comes out. And he's like, I can't go into the ladies' bathroom. So he I need to ask for help. Another husband, is out there waiting for his wife. His wife goes into the bathroom. And then like by the time they get help, there's like three or four husbands waiting for their wives and the bathroom like keeps essentially eating people. They send in like the janitor and the janitor never comes out of the ladies' bathroom. And like by the end of it, there's like a dozen people waiting for their wives to come out of the bathroom. And he's like, it's a good hook, right? And he tells this like on his like speaking engagements, or he did back in the 80s and 90s. And he would be like, it's a great hook. He's like, the only problem is I didn't know what the fuck was in the bathroom. it's like I could never figure that out. So like I never like that. I think he even like said, if you figure it out, you come up with an ending, right into the Stephen King fan club or whatever the fuck and do it. So
that's awesome.
So yes, he's got some, again, pee pee poo poo on his mind.
Yeah. No, that bathrooms story was scary speak places. To me. Yeah,
especially airport bathrooms. You ever 100%. Walk into a? I can't speak for the ladies' room experience, but the men's room is a fucking. It sounds like Howard Shore doing Mordor music in there, right? It's like, mm-hmm. it's just nothing but trombones going off left and
it
right.
It really
yeah,
is.
That's, yeah, that's Nick following his Burmese yes, exactly. dining experience.
I'm going to suggest to Stephen King that sometimes when we touch is playing very loudly in that women's bathroom. That's the secret.
Sometimes when we touch.
Yeah, and at the end of this appearance, Nick, you're going to open your eyes and you're still in that bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's going to be a loud stream.
It's like the jaunt, only for shitting.
It'll all be a dream.
You know, your first appearance on the show, we already covered your Stephen King origin story, so we don't need to go through that again. But we have dueling topics on this show today. Let's start with Holly. This is a novel that came out last year. Besby and I were big fans. Joe, I know you did not read it, but
I haven't read it.
Nick, what were your thoughts on Holly?
I loved the villains. It also was a little bit different than King stories I've read, in that it was just kind of a moonlighting style mystery where you find out who did the murders right away, and then it's all about how Holly Gibney gets to the bottom of it.
Right.
And had you not read any of the other Holly Gibney stories?
I haven't, but I purchased them all after reading this one because I thought she's such a great flawed character.
Yeah.
Do you feel like Stephen King's gotten better at writing women?
Absolutely.
Yeah, markedly. Yeah.
Okay. I felt like it was a pretty well realized character, and like, you know, smoker and neurotic, but clever and just felt very real.
Right. That dichotomy that like she's very adamant about wearing masks and protecting her health, but then she'll remove the mask to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of I started reading You Like It Darker. I read like the first four stories, and I feel like a lot of Stephen King's stuff is about aging now. And here you have the two villains, you know, professors who are trying to stave off, you know, aging and Alzheimer's by
Yeah,
sure. Okay. Course, yeah.
By killing and eating people. I just thought that was interesting about how they're willing to do anything to not feel the rigors of age.
Yeah.
And also, I've been vegan for about 30 years. So there was like, that was specifically referenced where they're like making a vegan eat kidney and stuff like that. And so it, and they even talked about the research about how it didn't really check out with, you know, eating kidneys, making, you know, reversing aging and all that. So,
Nick, I've always wondered that about being vegan. Like, if you bite off a fingernail, can you eat that, or is that not vegan? Because that's technically human.
Great question, Joe. I'm glad you asked it.
Why would you want to eat a fingernail?
I'm just saying, hypothetically, if he ate it, would he not be vegan anymore?
Well,
you know what I mean? That's a human product.
Tim Lee at Fantastic Fest asked me the same question because for their closing night party last year at the festival,
he
enlisted a doctor friend to take people's blood without them knowing why. And they had to sign something, but it's Texas, you know, so there's really no laws. And then at the end of the night, you were served a vegan blood sausage made with your own blood. And he asked me, would that be vegan? Would you eat it? And I had to think about it because, like, the rest of it wasn't actual meat in there. It was
because it's you.
It was soy and filler and all that. But then it had your blood to congeal it all. And I had to admit, I guess I would do it because it's not exploiting any animal except for yourself. So, and I was a willing participant.
Man, I had forgotten all about that. But
you signed up to do that, right?
I got invited to do it, and I was gonna do it because I was like, when else am I gonna have the chance to do this?
Yeah.
And I don't remember why. Oh, is it because I got COVID or was that the year before?
No, I think it's because it's a batshit insane thing to do. That's why you didn't do it.
No, there was
you
some
didn't get
other
COVID
reason.
At Fantastic like, Fest last year. I got COVID at Fantastic Fest last year.
That's true. Everybody I got it the year before.
I got it the year before too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was some reason I can't remember what it was now, but there was some reason I had to back out of it. I don't remember what it was, but I was all in on that shit.
Yeah. The needle part would be the only part that would deter me from that, you know, but,
you don't like getting blood drunk?
No, I have a tendency to pass out and I threw up one time. So,
I don't have that problem.
Yeah. If I don't have to give blood, I'm not going to, you know, but maybe
fuck all those people who need your blood.
Yeah,
exactly. I might get dizzy.
World's greatest film festival, folks.
And everybody on the corporate side said, you cannot do this, don't do it. But it got done. Somehow they found a way to make that happen.
Well, Tim League is Willy Wonka, so
for real.
He finds a way. Yeah.
Yeah, he is quite the character. Nick, to your point, Emily and Rodney Harris, the villains of Holly, are, in my opinion, like all-timer King villains. Like, I liked spending time with those characters more so than Holly, even, while reading the book. It was just fascinating to like listen to their thought process and what they were doing. I mean, they're clearly monsters, but I think like these characters are just all-timer villains for him.
Right, because they're brilliant, they're academics, but then Emily is racist, and you know, that comes out. And then their ploy of having, I believe it's Rodney, is in the electric scooter going up a ramp, and then they say it gets stuck and ask for help, and then they inject the person while they're trying to help him get up the ramp. You know, I thought that was a pretty brilliant ploy.
And how that's a Silence of the Lambs deal.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. It will, and I love how banal and mundane King makes it, because the first time it happens, you're like, fuck me, this is crazy, what a crazy thing. And then you realize they do it like six or seven times over the course of the book, and each time it's like, all right, which one of us is going to be in the wheelchair this time? I don't feel like it. You can do it. You get in the wheelchair this time. You know, it becomes one of those things, and it's like us like booking the show or somewhere, like, okay, who do we need? Okay, what time is that? Okay, we'll go do that. And so you realize, like, this monstrous thing that you were just shocked by at the beginning, it just becomes like, oh, who are they going to get this time? You know?
Yeah, that whole banality of evil thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, a lot of them you just find out about it afterwards, but there's one, I think, I don't know if it's with Bonnie or somebody, where it's just prolonged, and you're that one you're still wondering, like, is she going to get out of it, you know,
which is
close to the end.
Brilliant. And sorry for the spoilers, Joe, that's one of my favorite things about this story is I guess because of all the Silence of the Lambs parallels, you're kind of like, okay, I've seen this. Now this is the Catherine in the well, right? This is the girl that it's a race against time for Holly Gibney to save this captured girl that we get so much time spent with her and like in her head and all this stuff. You're like, okay, this is it. And then you like slowly start to realize as you're getting timeline clues, as he's bouncing back and forth between Holly and her, that I'm like, you're like, wait a minute, the timeline doesn't really work out. Something's wrong here, until you get to the point where she is killed and you realize this isn't about saving her. This is about, you know, preventing the next one. Right. And it's such a brilliant twist on expectation. You know, I don't know if King intended it that way, if that's just the way the story came out for him, but like, for me, it really was playing upon, you know, okay, I know how these genre stories work, so this is how this is gonna happen, and he's just like, fuck that. No, it's not.
That's what I was wondering, you know, because of the construction, and anytime you're doing kind of a mystery, there's the construction is important to it, but the way King writes, at least from my understanding, is just kind of pretty freewheeling, like chronologically. So, you know, no outlines. But has that changed, or do you think this was just, he's just that good that he's doing it in his head?
I think it's just he's that good and he's doing it in his head. But I also think that if I had to guess, and maybe this would be another good question to add to the should Stephen King come back, we can ask him document. If I had to guess, that I would say that his stuff like The Outsider or his more mystery, you know, thriller books, Holly being a good one recently, I would wager to guess that there's more revision going on and more like honing and tightening and going, okay, we need to move this here and this here, you know, just to make the pieces work better. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
But also this motherfucker has been doing this every day, you know, for the last 70 years, you know, it feels like, I guess not. Mm-hmm. He's like 76. So for the last 60 something years, he's been writing.
Yeah,
you know, he's
put in 3,000 words a day every plus.
Day. Yeah.
One so other I think thing, he just
knows it. Yeah,
I like too that they. I, you know, I haven't read the previous Holly Gibney books, but the fact that it's set up that she's a coffee drinker, she has a Starbucks tumbler. It's just sort of mentioned that she carries it wherever she goes, and then at the end, the way she's sort of rescued and the way Barbara finds her at the house is she sees her tumbler outside on the porch. And I just thought that was just a clever little detail that was just seated. You don't even notice it. It's just a character detail. But then that's what ultimately leads to her being found at the end.
Right. Well, what do you think about King operating in crime mode? This is like dominated his last like 10 years of output or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the first one I've read in that genre by King, but I was like, he did it. I mean, he pulled it off well, and like I say, it didn't unfold where you're trying to guess who the killers are. You're told it from the beginning. So it's more just like seeing like the cleverness of the protagonist figuring it out.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
So I thought that was a good framing device. I don't know if the others are done that way, but... yeah, I'm on board. What other Holly books? What's the next one people should read if they read Holly?
Well, If It Bleeds is the one that you should probably... It's the novella that's in that collection of the same name, If It Bleeds. That's the one that kind of feels like most in line. It really is The Outsider, If It Bleeds, and then Holly, as Holly is being one of the main characters of it. The books that she's introduced in are the Bill Hodges trilogy. So that's Mr. Mercedes and Finders Keepers.
End of Watch.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the title I always forget. But what's crazy about those books is that Holly she's not a main character until like the second book. She's just somebody who's like the sister of somebody in the first book. And King has said that like people have asked him why he gravitated towards her, because she is essentially just a background character for the majority of Mr. Mercedes. And he's just like, I don't know what it is about her, but she, the second that she showed up sitting, you know, outside, you know, it was like outside of a church on a bench and, you know, smoking a cigarette, there was something about her that intrigued King. And she just like grabbed on and wouldn't let go. Yeah.
Scott, what do you think about the mysteries? What's your opinion?
Well, I haven't read the Bill Hodges trilogy. Mm-hmm. I've said this before on the show, but you know, we're getting to a point where there will come a day where there are no more Stephen King books, you know? And I have set aside like those three. The Institute is another one that I haven't read. I haven't read the Gwendy's Button Box series. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that I've just kind of like filed away as I've got these like banked. And
you're like a doomsday prepper, but for Stephen King novels.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Wow.
You know,
that's impressive.
but I did read. I read Holly. I read The Outsider. I think he's exceptional at writing crime novels, and I would strongly advise you to read Billy Summers, which is another one he did in the last few years. That's just like a fucking like super pulpy. It's about like a hitman, and that one goes to some weird and wild places. It's like reading Stephen King writing an exploitation movie. Basically,
oh, nice.
About a hitman, and you guys, it is fucking awesome.
You had mentioned the novella. Like, I remember one of the most fun reading experiences with Stephen King was when The Green Mile came out, and they were released like I don't know, like 100 pages at a time. Yeah. And each month at the bookstore, a new one would come out, and that was my favorite. Because first of all, I have a short attention span, so like to get a big thick book like. You know, a big old doorstop and read that, that's intimidating to me. But when it comes out 100 pages at a time, you have something to look forward to every month. Has he done that since The Green Mile?
No.
Oh, I wish he would do that again.
No, and that was a really cool experiment, you know?
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it was successful.
Well, like, you probably made more money that way too, right? I mean,
probably.
Yeah, because you're selling them at like $6 a pop or five or six bucks a pop. And
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
He frequently does shit like that though. Like, he did that. He released The Plant, which was like a Kindle exclusive thing when it first came out. I think it eventually appeared in one of the collections, but
it was Ur, or whatever, that was the Kindle,
yes.
Right? Ur.
Yes. You're right.
Because that one was all about a magic Kindle. So
that's true. But yeah, he will like fuck around with like the format of the releases from time to time, and it's always fun when he does that.
Yeah, you can kind of sit there and think about it for a little while, and then a week later it comes out in B. Dalton. You know, Walden
Books. Like, it's the equivalent of, like, I've gotten to a point where I don't like binging shows, and I have more respect for a show that's rolling out like on a weekly release schedule. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I think it's more helpful for the show in general to, you know, keep the conversation going versus like something that drops all at once and then you get like one weekend's worth of commentary about it.
Yeah.
Fucking social media.
No, and I think my brain retains it better too, because, you know,
absolutely,
like, Curb Your Enthusiasm would come out once a week and then I would watch it and then I would just like think about it all week and then the next one comes out instead of just like this muddle of binging. And yeah
absolutely. It's been a while since he's done something like that, but you know, hopefully he does it again. Like,
yeah, I hope so.
He's always been oddly like on the cutting edge of things, as he's like one of the first back, you know, he wrote his first books on typewriters, but he was one of the first people to jump to like word processors and whatever, back when like the authors at the time were like, no, that technology is it demeans the art, you know, kind of stuff. And he was always very forward thinking, but sometimes that resulted in, you know, him being ahead of the curve, and sometimes that resulted in him, you know, I don't know, making a CD-ROM a CD-ROM thing full of screensavers that were Stephen King themed, and dated very quickly. If King had successfully become a director, like he would have absolutely been making movies for Tubi you know, and doing like the 6-minute vertical, you know, things, because he loves experimenting with all that stuff. I don't know how much he still to this day does, but like as recently as, I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago, he was still fucking around with all that stuff with the
Kindles. Do you know what his process is today? Like, does he, I assume it's still on a computer. I don't know. It's all, I guess it probably hasn't evolved that much since computers came around.
No, my understanding is it's still at the computer. And so he just, I don't know what he writes in, but.
I wonder if he's one of those standing up guys. You know, stands up at the computer.
Maybe not after the van accident and having to get his lower body replaced and stitched back together. Yeah. I would imagine that dude's not standing for any long period.
Uncle Steve needs a rest.
Right.
Yeah. No, but he does. He walks. He still does his walks and whatnot.
Yeah.
So he's mobile, but I don't know about standing. But yeah.
Well, we loved Holly. I got a copy of You Like It Darker. Just yesterday, actually, and I haven't cracked into it yet, but I understand there's a story in there that is very revival-esque, and that's, you know, as frequent listeners of this show know, that is like our go-to recommend Stephen King title, and that's what made me like order it. I was kind of like, well, I'll get around to it in a minute, and then I read a review that was like, you know, this particular story is like him working in like Lovecraftian territory, and there's a lot of revival overtones in this and shit. And I was like, order, like, instantly.
Right. There is a supernatural story at the beginning, like an alien story, but it's done in a really cool, interesting way. And there's one about alcoholism, and it's got all the classic King tropes so far, but I'm loving it.
I'm excited to dive into it as soon as I have a fucking free minute to sit down and crack it open. But
you ever do the audiobooks? Because I started listening to the audiobooks or the audiobook version of it when it came out. And the guy who narrates it, Will Patton, is so good. He's doing like a Maine accent for a couple of the stories. And
Does he read the whole book?
Yeah, Stephen King chimes in, but otherwise he's doing all the narration. Patton's really good.
Patton's done a number of King audiobooks, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I've listened to him do another one too. But it's an interesting way. I think that's my first King audiobook, but he's really good.
I have a hard time with audiobooks in that, like, my mind wanders and I find myself like kind of paying attention to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, with a book in my, like, a physical book in my hands, like, I'm just absorbing the writing better. And so, like, I will do audiobooks, like, if I have a long drive to make or something like that. But otherwise, I would prefer the...
I do both sometimes, you know? So, and then I'll read back. It just, like, helps my retention even more if I'm... Yeah, I'm the same way with
audiobooks. Version of those plug and play things that we had as kids where it's like, here's the story of Indiana Jones and when the whip cracks, turn the page. I said craps. That's funny. When the whip cracks, turn the page. And I've done that.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've done that where you read along.
Audiobooks, I'm like seven chapters. I'm like, I didn't pay attention to any of that. You know, like, and I have to always back it up. My brain is just all over the place.
It depends what I'm doing. I've oddly enough for You Like It Darker, I was able to track down a copy. As a matter of fact, it was my girlfriend Kel. She, like, we were at HEB and she's like, you know, they have the new King is over there. And it was like the weekend before it came out. And it was just like, yeah, you fucking grocery stores don't give a shit about drop dates. Right. And so I picked it up and I read that first story, the alien one that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I found that I was like, my mind was wandering more reading it. And then when I had pre-ordered the audiobook already. And so I essentially started it from the beginning and I was like picking up things that my eyes had just like skipped over while reading. So I don't know why, but like I had the exact opposite reaction with this particular one where I was finding it hard to focus, you know, with the physical pages. Maybe I'm just, I'm getting old and used to hearing books now. I don't know what's going on.
I think you can blame your phone for that one. You know, I just,
yes. Like, well, I blame my phone for
everything. Fans are fucking shot.
Yep.
Yeah. My reading level has, it's probably at a sixth grade level now because of my stupid phone.
I decided to reread it this year and try to finish it by, I think it was released in like September of 86. I made a goal. I'm going to finish it by September. I started it in January.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm halfway through. It's, I mean, I love it, but it's just, I think I had more time to read or more appetite for it when it came out than I do as an adult.
Yeah.
What I find is that I spend so much time online reading other things, like for the job. You know, either research for the show or research for any of the other shows we're doing or just entertainment news. Or I also write news for Fangoria's website every morning. It's just like at the end of the day when I've got a few hours to kill, hopefully, the last thing I want to do is like sit down and read more.
Right.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And that's such a fucking bummer.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I told this story last time we were on, but when the new It movie premiered, I happened to be doing a college show in Bangor, Maine. We do those shows solo, so it was just me there, and I got to town early, and I'm like, I've always wanted to see Stephen King's house with like the bat gates and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to. It's a rite of passage.
Yeah, so I'm like, all right, I'm going to do that, and it was like the Friday that the new It Part 1 came out, and so I'm like, I'm going to go to Party City and just tie a single red balloon on the gate as like a tribute, you know. So I go
Nick
to Party
has some time on his hands.
Yeah. So I go to Party City and I'm like, I just want one red helium balloon. And she's like, oh, you're going to tie it to his gate like everybody else today? And I was like, oh, I guess I wasn't the only one. Never mind. I'll just go to the gate. Yeah.
Well, we must have narrowly missed each other because my first time in Bangor, I was doing a set visit in Boston and I rented a car and I drove up to Bangor And this was shortly after, I think, Scott, you did your Dark Tower thing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went, but I did the same thing. I was there like in and out, so I didn't really didn't have time to do the SK Tours thing or whatnot. But I'm like, I'll be goddamned if I don't see the Paul Bunyan statue, the standpipe, and Stephen King's house. So, so like I drove up there, I took my pictures in front of the house and whatnot. And then that evening, I'm sitting there going, man, like I'm bored. I got nothing better to do. And one of the Conjuring movies, maybe, it was in the Conjuring universe movie was playing. And I went to go see it at a shitty fucking movie theater that was right next to the Bangor airport. And it was one of those theaters where the ticket taker was like some high school kid also was the only one running concessions, who also was the one that was hitting play on the digital projector. Right?
Those are my one favorites. Person.
Yeah. And it was like a shoebox theater, and I was like one of like three people in it, and it reminded me of the movie theaters I grew up in, where you know, there is no such thing as stadium seating or recliner seats,
no,
or
sticky floors.
Sticky floors, yeah. The seats were barely bolted on and like creaked every time you shifted your weight, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm sitting there watching it, and they were doing a preview of it before the movie, and so it showed the entirety of the Georgie Pennywise scene, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning of the movie, and I'm just like, hell yeah, this is so perfect to be sitting here. So I think it was maybe a month before it came out. So I think that we were
just
ships passing
in
the night.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And I'm was probably the 15th person to have the red balloon idea that day. Yeah. So
Nick, instead you dressed up as Pennywise then, right? You got the clown makeup and you did
that.
Hey,
I was
instead
at Party City. I mean, come on.
Yeah, when in Rome. Yeah. No, I love the story.
And he stole the first child he saw and dragged him into a sewer.
I get really into it, yeah.
I love the story that when King was on your podcast, didn't he tell the story about Japanese tourists coming out and watching his dog take a shit? Wasn't that was that with you guys?
I don't know. I don't think so. That doesn't sound like something
he
said with us.
I feel like I heard it, and maybe I dreamed it. I don't know, but like he said that like a bunch of Japanese tourists, or it was just tourists in general, I don't know why I'm thinking Japanese, came out and saw him in the yard with his dog, and his dog was taking a shit during it. They were all snapping pictures of it. So I wonder I'd like to see his perspective from like looking out his window every so often at the weirdo fans who congregate. Yeah.
I would hate that so much. I don't want to be perceived by anyone.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it, like to have people standing in front of your house round the clock. Like, I mean, I know he doesn't live there much at this point, but like, Jesus Christ, that's got to be awful. Right.
I feel like he thinks of himself kind of as like a main hick, basically, you know, like Jordy a little bit the movie because like I just feel like he's like he spends a lot of time at home, and you know, there's a lot of TV, and he's kind of as thinks of himself as like a yokel, you know.
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, and to be fair, I don't think he's actually lived in the Stephen King house in like over 20 years, you know. I think he's got a place, I think, outside of Bangor, and he's got a place like deep in the Maine that he spends time in, and then his place in Florida where he spends all the winters now.
That place in Florida is nuts. Like, if you look up pictures of it, it looks like a fucking mall. It is huge.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like on the coast. It's like while we're talking, like, go Google Stephen King Florida house and check that shit out.
He just doesn't seem like a Florida man to me, you know. Just kind of weird to hear that he's spends a lot of time in Florida. I mean, Florida,
well, all old people gravitate towards Florida for starters,
especially if they grew up in harsh winters, I guess, and spend most of the life in harsh winters. They just say fuck this second that leaves turn, they get out.
This place looks like a museum. I'm looking at it now.
It's so weird because it compare it and contrast to, because that was Stephen King's house, the one with the wrought iron gate with the bats and the spiders and shit, you know, melded into it. How much personality that has. And you look at that house and you go, yes, the master of horror lives in this house. Right. Yeah. You look at the Florida house, you go, yes, somebody who was a manager at an Apple store that got really popular, you know, lives in this house, you know.
Yeah. I listened to Howard Stern, and he talked about how he's in the winters. He goes to Florida, and he's recording from his basement there. And for some reason, I'm picturing just a regular house basement while he's broadcasting. And then I saw the photos, and the thing probably takes like a staff of 30 to run. I mean, it's like the size of a city.
Yeah, and basement is in quotation marks.
Yeah, yeah. Here's another Long Island.
It looks like the war room and. The war room and Dr. Strangelove.
It does, right. Yeah. It's enormous. It probably has like two zip codes and, you know, I mean, it's like huge. So I just can't even relate to it. But
I think technically we're supposed to talk about Creepshow.
Right.
You know, this has been a very
we want Joe to be able to have
enjoyable
some,
conversation. Exactly. Joe, you have not read Holly. So you
I haven't. I'm going to
really
now.
Weigh in although, on that. But
although I know everything that happens now, but I still want to read it.
Well, tell us your thoughts on Creepshow.
So Creepshow, I hadn't seen since I was doing the math. Like I was probably seven or 8 years old when I first saw it, which is pretty young, but it was one of those everyday on HBO shows, you know? Right. And so you'd just turn on HBO and it would just be on. You'd catch it in the middle. And I probably haven't seen it since then. My dad was or is a big Stephen King fan, and we always had Stephen King books all over the on the shelves and everything. And I think that he was pretty liberal with letting us watch Stephen King horror stuff. And so I was 8 at the time, which I don't know, maybe that's not too young, but maybe it's a little too young. And he was fine with that. But my brother was like 3 or 4. And he watched Creepshow with us one time, and he got so scared by the head on the cake. He says, most people don't remember things from when they were 3, but he does. And that's the only thing he remembers from when he was 3. And he was so scared shitless by it. And my mom still hasn't forgiven my dad for this, for letting him watch it. But he was so scared shitless of the room that he watched it in that he wouldn't go into the living room to watch TV. Like he would sit outside of the living room and sit in a chair and watch TV from, you know, the dining room because he was so scared of that room because of that. So that was my memory of it, is just like the trauma it caused my brother and just me thinking it was the coolest thing ever. And I rewatched it last night for the first time in, you know, whatever, 40 years. And man, I fucking loved it. An all-star cast of Tom Savini and George Romero and Stephen King all working together on the same movie. And just the stories. There's a part of me, my 2024 brain was like, hey, wait a second. They just turned into zombies for no reason. They're just zombies. You know, there's a part of me that was like, wait a second, this kind of sucks. Like, there's no reason that they turned into zombies. There's no ancient Indian burial ground that caused them to do this. They just turned into it. But then I remembered, you know, this is based off of those pulp comics. And they did just that. It's just like, okay, they're just zombies all of a sudden. So I forgave it for story-wise and just enjoyed just the spectacle of the comics and the green screens and the turning colors behind their heads. And, man, I fucking loved it.
Do you like, in general, do you like an anthology movie?
I do. I mean, I was brought up on Twilight Zone. My dad was, you know, very Fuck early. Yeah. My dad was always watching Twilight Zone and so I always gravitate towards those. And especially for somebody with a short attention span like me, like it's just 22 minutes. That's perfect. That's a perfect story length. So yes, I've always loved that.
I'm mad that more anthology movies don't exist.
Yeah.
Like, well, there's, you know, we have VHS now, and you know, that's kind of that franchise has sort of taken the lead on anthology horror movies over the last decade or however long it's been. But like, I just feel like if I was running Netflix, I would have a show called Skeleton Crew, and then I would bring in directors to direct different episodes based on short stories from that collection.
Yeah.
And then you would do Night Shift or Nightmares and Dreamscapes or whatever the fuck. Like, it seems like such an obvious idea. And when we have talked to filmmakers about this in the past, about like, why don't we see more of this? It's always just like, they don't fucking make money. Like, no one gives a shit.
Right. Like, I feel, and, like, also, like, streaming and, you know, series have kind of eaten that up, you know? Like, I feel like Black Mirror, stuff like that. I mean, it feels, yeah, but you're talking, like, just a 90-minute movie that is four different stories. That kind of anthology? Yeah.
Like, why isn't there a Star Wars anthology movie? You know? Why isn't there, like, I don't understand. Like,
And, so digestible.
And I don't understand the reluctance of people to show up for these fucking things, because, you know, to your point about having a short attention span, like, to me, that's like the fucking platonic ideal of a movie. You know, you check in, you check out, if you don't like this story, well, maybe you'll like the next one.
Right. You don't have to wait that long. You get the new one. Yeah.
Plus, it gives those sort of like directors like Ty West or like Mike Flanagan or people like, you know, like they kind of got their start doing some of those shorts and things. So it's a good showcase for, you know, directors who are get their start and then go on to make features.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a good pipeline for that too, to find the next stable of, you know, Netflix directors or show creators.
Yeah. What did they do in the 90s? That Four Rooms with Quentin Tarantino and,
Cat's Eye was an anthology. Cat's Eye.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Cat's Eye is good as fuck, too.
That's so good. That holds up, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel bad for the cat in that, but other than that,
having to dance on the shock floor.
Yeah, that's pretty disturbing. But
I think about that movie every time I see a cat and a baby in the same room. Like, I just... comes right back to me.
Are you protecting it from a troll or trying to steal its breath? I don't know which. Yes.
Right.
I love that troll. That one's my favorite. Yeah.
Who was it that came on the show that was doing the troll impression. Voice? It was Rich Summer from Mad Men.
Yeah, Summer.
Oh,
yeah.
That's Frank Welker. who's in every cartoon voice from the 80s. Frank Welker.
Yeah. Megatron and Skeletor.
And did all like, and if there's ever an animal sound on The Simpsons or anything, it was always Frank Welker doing like a dog and a cat fighting. And I recognized his voice instantly when I rewatched Cat's Eye recently.
Well, Nick, what do you make of Creepshow?
I loved it too. I hadn't watched it in a while and rewatched it. And it's hard to pick a favorite. I guess I love the animated sequence. There's something about it. I don't know if it was rotoscoped or just the animation was cool and very playful, how it would be like, you know, 15 years earlier, and it would kind of have this cool like outline that looked like it was out of a comic book page. So I thought the framing was good. And obviously this was successful because Tales from the Dark Side came out and kind of did the same thing, almost the exact same thing with the, and then the Tales from the Crypt TV show. And, you know, it was very similar. My favorite one is, Something to Tide You Over with Leslie Nielsen. I just love Leslie Nielsen as the villain so much.
Oh, and he nails it.
And it also, it also like gets that panic of being buried in sand. Like this, like a, that sort of torture is very visceral. Like for me anyway, it really gets me. So,
Well, I always find myself holding my breath whenever the person on screen has to hold their breath. I do that a lot.
Yeah.
Also, what one other thing with Creepshow that I don't think I knew about before was that the very first time you see a human in the shot, it's a little boy getting slapped. Like, I was like, man, I forgot about this part.
And it's Stephen King's son, right?
Isn't that Joe
Hill?
No, there was one of those trivia things that popped up on Amazon. You know how they have trivia about scenes?
Right.
And they said that Stephen King had taken Joe to, like, a drive-in movie, or maybe it was a restaurant or something, and the Tom Savini had made him up with like bruises and, you know, to make him look all beat up, and they went there. They did it as a joke, but the person at the restaurant called the cops because it was
it was a drive-through or something, wasn't it? I think there's
a drive-through, that's
McDonald's
what it was.
Or something.
Yeah.
I want to go back to this thing about you holding your breath.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I do this, too. Maybe it puts me square on the spectrum, but I do this, too.
I also do it over bridges, too. If I cross a bridge, I don't know if somebody put that in my head, that you hold your breath whenever you cross a bridge. I do that all the time just to see. I don't know why.
That I don't do.
What the fuck?
You should try it. You'd like it.
This is bizarre. Like, this is truly bizarre. Well, like, why are you... What about that Mission Impossible movie where Tom Cruise holds his breath on screen for, like, 4 minutes?
No, we just pass out. Yeah.
Or The Abyss.
Yeah.
No, I have severe brain damage right now. Yeah.
From lack of oxygen.
Yeah. No, it's not good over here.
You watch The Abyss too many times. So.
But is the idea that you're trying to match the experience that you're trying to, or like,
to see if I can do it? Yeah, to see if mm-hmm. I could, if I could survive it when the, like, that one scene when Ted Danson's wife is the water keeps, you know, waterboarding her. I'll hold my breath when she's getting all the water in her face, and then it washes back down, and then I can take some breaths. And maybe I'm just preparing for when that happens to me, you know, to see if I could do it. But she legitimately looked like she was getting waterboarded in that. The water was coming in and, like, going up her nose. It looked.
I know. Yeah. I can't imagine that filming.
And the amount of trust, because I know there must be some easy escape mechanism or something for them there. But whatever the thing is, whether it's their body in a tank or they're, you know, they can just duck under. I have no idea how they pulled off the shots, but, like, it's not just as easy as going, okay, I'm free of this. There's got to be a process. So there's got to be so much trust placed in the people.
I was thinking the summer when I go to the beach that I want to try to do the arms on my side and see if you really can't get out. Because when Ted Danson was like, oh, I can't move my arms, I was like, oh, you probably could. You could probably, like, dig with your fingers a little bit. So I want to, that's my summer experiment. I'll get back to you guys.
It is. Yeah. There's a real low level prank that you can do that I've been doing with having to do with something tidying you over. Is, like, you know, the pictures that just come in 8x10 picture frames at Target they always have pictures of couples on the beach in them. Uh-huh. And if you print out little pictures of Ted Danson with a pile of sand, you know, around him, you take the picture out of that and put him at the bottom near the couple's feet, and then you put it back into the picture frame. And You never get to see the payoff, but you can imagine somebody buying that and getting it home and then noticing Ted Danson's head on the beach right at the tide. So
right.
Just an easy
you do that enough, you're going to be able to find somebody posting on Instagram going, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. I mean, that's the dream. That's what you
hope. That's the hope. I've done it to a few different, like a Michaels and the Target in my neighborhood. So we'll see.
Maybe you've actually done this?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Love it.
Speaking of pranks, you know, Chop and Steal, which I will, you know, go to bat for any day of the week. Once again, like, everyone listening to this, please go watch Chop and Steal.
Yes.
Kind of ends on a note of you might do another big prank. And it feels like it's been a while since you've done that. Like, are you working on something? Like, are you strategizing? Like, you're very good at this.
Yeah, a little bit. The thing is, between all of them, I think we did three different ones. We did Kenny Strasser, the yo-yo expert, and that was like 2010. I think 2014 was Chef Keith, the celebrity chef who taught you what to do with your Thanksgiving leftovers. We waited 4 years after that one. And then Chop and Steal, I think, was like 4 years later after that. So we kind of, historically, we've done it every 4 years. It's more when inspiration strikes rather than like, oh, we never feel the pressure, like we have to do it. The you know, we're probably due for one now, but the pandemic slowed that down, and it we're coming out of a time when it didn't really feel like, I don't really want to fuck with people right now. Like, I don't really want to we didn't have the motivation, but we have some ideas for this. We're working on our Volume 11 show, and there's we have one idea that we're pretty excited about. So
there's like a post credit scene Marvel style in the at the end of Chop and Steal where it shows a prank we did. I guess we could tell the story of we found a home movie called Jeff's Birds, and it was Jeff's was had an apostrophe S, but so did Birds. You know, where people just think they need to add an apostrophe when there's an S. So Bird apostrophe.
One of my favorite things in the world.
And in it, it's just a guy. It's a home movie of a guy whose name isn't Jeff, by the way, but he's filming around a house. You never really see any birds, but at one point he finds a bunny rabbit and sings a song to it. And so that was in our last show. So we developed a prank, a character where Joe played a character named Jeff Bird. And instead of doing crafting like normal artisan crafts, he did what we called man crafts. So he was, making a squatty potty out of old car batteries and making it into Dallas Cowboy scenes, and,
like manly crafts.
We also had a public access show from Madison, Wisconsin, featuring a guy who was doing watercolor painting using his own spit as the water. Huh. And so we decided to have, Jeff Bird's main form of art be making spit paintings.
But it wasn't just spitting. It was like doing the, that kind of spitting so that you had to do it on air.
The hawking.
Yes. Hawking a loogie. Yeah.
We did it. We got on a morning show in Waco, Texas, and we had a guy as our assistant there who is recording behind the scenes stuff covertly. So we have the footage. You see a little bit of it in the documentary. But the segment was supposed to air live, but George Bush Sr. died that morning, and it's Texas, so we got preempted.
Yeah, so they had to pre-tape it, and when they pre-tape it, that's when they know it's bullshit. So, yeah, so they never aired it, but we at least got to go on. We got some footage from it. So,
I recently got the raw footage that the behind-the-scenes guy shot, so I think we'll cut it into something. So you'll finally be able to see that, prank that never aired.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it. I mean, that was like 2018, 2019. I haven't seen it in so long. But I remember when we were rehearsing it, having tears streaming down my cheeks. Like, I can't believe we're going to say this to the person.
Yeah.
We'll cut that together and we'll upload that.
Yeah, I remember it going really well, but they just never aired it. So I'm excited to see it again.
And looking at your, tour schedule for the next few months, you're in New Jersey, you're in Kentucky. I don't see an Austin date. Like, when are you coming back?
Fuck, guys?
We played Austin at Fantastic Fest. That's we're on this Volume 10 tour. So this is our latest tour, and we're at the tail end of it. So I think we only have 4 shows of Volume 10, and then we'll start working on Volume 11, and then we'll bring that back to Austin for sure.
Well,
we just want to see it, and I don't know if you remember when you guys were at Fantastic Fest doing it, they programmed our live show, I think, against yours.
Yeah. I told them not to do that this year because we can announce we will be back at Fantastic Fest, and we're planning a loose circus theme to the show we're doing. So
we're gonna play all of our lion tamer training videos.
Well, you say that, but we have a lot of. I found one about how to teach your dog circus tricks. We have so many clown videos. And so it's a loose theme, but it'll be a 3-ring circus of VHS that night. No.
I think it's probably fair to say that we will be back at Fantastic Fest this year. Maybe not with this show, but we will be there. And I'm determined to see. Like, I remember I ran into you, Nick. In the highball last year, and I think you were like, well, tomorrow we're going up to Dallas to do a show.
Right.
Yeah. So if you want to come up for that, and I was like, I'm not driving to fucking Dallas.
I would have known.
Yeah. but
there's a Bucky's
very
on the way.
Unfortunate that they scheduled us opposite one another.
Yeah, I was bummed. I've told the powers that be, please don't do that, because I want to see what you're going to do this year at Fantastic Fest. And
hey, let me ask you guys this. So when you guys are doing the podcast for a live audience, we do a show called Saturday Morning Cartoons, where we watch old shitty Saturday morning cartoons from the golden age. But we did that one for a live audience, and I was thrown off because I didn't know if I should be playing for the live audience or if I should perform for the podcast audience. How do you guys do it? What's your strategy?
I don't think we've ever sat down and figured out a strategy. I think
we wing it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's mostly that. I think that we play for what's in front of us. At least that's what I do but it's really not all that different from doing the show now. I mean, you're doing it in front of an audience, but you're getting immediate feedback, which is good to know if a joke lands or whatnot. But it's we're such the a loosey-goosey show anyway.
Fantastic Fest last year.
Not last year, yeah. But that's because they tried a social experiment by seeing how hot the room could possibly get before people started passing out.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And everybody was full of their own blood sausage. So
yes. And they just given all their blood.
Yep.
Like half an hour before the show, someone at Fantastic Fest came to me and was like, hey, do you want to come check out the setup? And we were like, or I was like, yeah, sure. And I walked into the theater and there's like 20 seats in there, maybe. And I was like, oh, this is a small room. And then how do I explain this? the setup did not work at all. Like what they had with the chairs, you know, up the, at the front of the room, we were like, well, this isn't going to work. We've got like three people coming on and we don't want to sit in director's chairs. We're fat guys. Like we don't want to, like, this is the worst possible chair to sit in.
Director's chair sucks.
Flattering chair. Yes. And, but I was like, but my real concern here is, why is it so hot in this room? And they were like, oh yeah, about that. This room's air conditioning is connected to the highball and the AC is just off in there, but we've got someone working on it, so it should be fine.
We got some box fans coming in.
Yeah.
That would have been something.
30 minutes later, we were in there. Like, Vespi and I are just pouring fucking sweat. All of our guests, you know, we're pouring sweat. In front of this crowd that mostly appeared to be asleep. And then we found out after the show that they didn't have drink service.
Oh, no.
They thought they were doing us a favor by not, you know, having something interrupting the live show. But for my eyes, what I saw was, for 90% of it, it's like a fucking 1930s tent revival where people are just fanning themselves with menus.
Right.
And just not really reacting to much. And then people would get up and leave and I'd be like, oh fuck, man, it's already a small room. And then they would come back with water or something. And it didn't occur to me until after that they were just like, fuck this, I can't do this. And they had to go out and say, I need a water, give me water. And then they came back with their drinks.
So
because they couldn't order anything. Yeah.
So don't play a sauna is what you're saying.
That's that hasn't been our best experience.
Yeah.
But I mean, for the most part, like, again, like the live show we did in Bangor with Mike and Kate, minus we had a little audience interaction at the end where they got to ask some questions or whatever. But minus that, it felt like just doing a good episode of the show that we got an instant response to.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. All right.
But I mean, the show's designed to be that kind of loosey goosey conversational thing anyway.
At all, ever.
Yeah.
Well,
no, you shouldn't.
Sometimes.
Yeah. That would be bad. Yeah.
Well, if you get air conditioning this year and you need any diarrhea or snoring stories,
you know who to call.
Yep. Yes. We're your man.
Into it. Yeah. No, and you know, just to give them their due, like the head of Fantastic Fest, Lisa and Tim League, like everybody apologized so profusely, you know, for it afterwards. And
it was a whole lot of stuff. Yeah,
it was a whole series of shit that went wrong to make that happen. But last year was also kind of a clusterfuck year for Fantastic Fest because that's when they got rid of the lobby and didn't know what to really do. Their plans didn't really work to keep people cooled off in that Texas late summer heat. You know,
One thing when we were hanging out with Tim League, and I don't know if you guys saw this, but. Oh, I forgot. Oh, who was it? Leonard Nimoy.
Did you guys
see the Leonard Nimoy plaque around the back?
Yeah, I was there. Well, I wasn't there when he took the piss, but I was at that screening that he was outside waiting to come into
really?
Take the piss. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. No, he showed us the plaque. So people who go to Fantastic Fest, if you walk around the building by like some dumpsters,
the left
some
side. Employing,
yeah, the left side, if you're looking at it straight ahead, go to the left side. There's a plaque of Leonard Nimoy where Leonard Nimoy took a piss. So that was an eye opener for me.
So
celebrities, they're just like us.
They're just like us. They piss on the side of the Alamo. So that was a screening of Wrath of Khan, that quote unquote Wrath of Khan, that was like 3 weeks before the new Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek came out, right? And everybody bought their tickets for Wrath of Khan. There was a retro screening. We're there, and then they go to do the intro, and then they go, sorry, something's wrong with the print kind of thing. And then out steps fucking Leonard Nimoy and holding film cans and like, we're going to give you the new movie instead. Sorry. Wow. And everybody lost their fucking minds, and it was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And so that was that experience.
He didn't want to ruin the surprise, so bless his heart, he just peed.
He didn't.
Instead of going in, he just peed on the side of the building.
That's exactly why he did it, because he knew that if he went into the restroom, somebody would see him and it would blow the surprise.
Yeah. I hope he washed his hands before he handled those film cans. So
he didn't, but it's Leonard Nimoy, so he didn't fucking miss a drop. He got nothing on them hands. He's fine.
Exactly. Good stuff.
We all know Leonard Nimoy is known for never pissing on his hands.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, look it up. It says it in his Wikipedia.
Yeah, oh. It will after this episode. All right.
Well, gentlemen, we are very happy to have spoken to you again today. And we're really looking forward to, brushing shoulders at the at Fantastic Fest this year. Thank you for being here. And I have nothing further to add. Best be you. Yeah. Anything?
No, thanks I really like this kind of splitting up topics thing. This is, it's kind of kept the show a little bit more lively, which I like. So this is a lot of fun. And thanks for bringing two titles and letting us kind of talk about two different eras of King. It was fun.
Awesome. You guys are great. Hey. Love
Thanks
it.
For having us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Many thanks to Nick Prewer and Joe Pickett for the chat. Going through the edit on these things is a little rough still, but it is good to hear Scott's voice. And as much as it makes me sad, it's good for it to be out there. And I'm glad that we still have some of Pop to listen to. Speaking of, this Friday on our Patreon, we will have more Wampler as we head into the end game on Shelbyville Season 2. This is our Stephen King-themed RPG series run by Jacob Hall and played by your KingCast co-host and Mallory O'Mara. This Friday, you're going to be getting the first of our epic two-part conclusion to the season, and our ragtag group is joined by none other than super special guest star Kate Siegel. You know, if you haven't listened to any Shelbyville, give it a shot. Tabletop RPGs might not be your thing, but you wouldn't believe the amount of people who didn't give a shit about that and still fell in love with these zany characters and their misadventures. Plus, you get to hear Mallory yell at Scott a lot, which is always a bonus. Next week in the main feed, we continue with the Wampler Files as we interview the filmmakers behind the recent Pennywise doc and Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Cemetery. That is John Campopiano and Justin White. And in the chat, we grill them about putting together these kind of docs and talk a lot about their part in preserving some of this pop culture history with them. You will get me and Wampler doing that interview next week in the main feed. And this Friday on our Patreon, hold on to your butts for Shelbyville Season 2, Episode 12. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.